Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is September 8th, 2012. And what you are about to hear is part three in our Logic Saves Lives series. Today's installment is called The Most Dangerous Superstition. Our special guest is Larkin Rose, and he is the author of the book, The Most Dangerous Superstition. And I cannot recommend this enough. I'm holding a copy in my hand right now. And I just want to read you a little bit from the jacket. Do softcover books have jackets? Is this called the jacket? No, it's called the cover. Make a note of that, cover. Most people, looking at our troubled world with its long history of injustice and human suffering, will attribute social evils to the greed, ignorance, hatred, or lack of compassion of others. Rarely does anyone consider the possibility that his own attitudes, perceptions, and beliefs may be the root cause of most of the world's suffering. But in almost every case, they are. The vast majority of theft, extortion, intimidation, harassment, assault, and even murder, the vast majority of man's inhumanity to man, comes not from greed, hatred, and intolerance that lurks in our hearts, but from one pernicious and almost universal assumption, one unquestioned belief, one irrational, self-contradictory superstition that affects all races, all religions, all nationalities, ages, and income levels. If humankind could give up this one false idea, even without otherwise acquiring another scrap of wisdom or compassion, the vast majority of injustice and oppression in the world would instantly cease. But this cannot happen until people are ready and willing to turn their judgmental eyes upon themselves, to objectively examine their own belief systems, to recognize and understand, and finally to abandon the most dangerous superstition. Some of you might know a little bit about what that is, but we are going to get way into it in the show today. So we use the book to guide our conversation. And our topic, this is our first fallacy that we're exploring in detail, is the appeal to authority, the argumentum ad verecundium. Now, we are going to get into this in the show, so I'm going to leave it right there. I just want to say thank you to Larkin for doing this. He stayed on Skype with me for a total, I would say, 4.5 hours, roughly. He did a pre-show with me for about a half an hour. He did the whole regular show for 2 hours, and then we did a two-hour after show. And today's podcast is carefully mined out of the two-hour live show. So I've done a lot of editing here to make this a podcast that is as tight as possible. But that means a lot had to be left on the old cutting room floor there. So I want you to be able to hear that too. So I'm going to release a supplemental show after this that is just Larkin taking phone calls from listeners. And I'm probably going to put the after show in the podcast feed as well, so you can hear that. And I think that's really all we need in the form of an introduction here. Let's get this show on the road. Remember when people used to say that all the time? And they weren't even talking about a show? And none of them even had shows? I've got a show. So this is it. Episode 160 of School Sucks Podcast, Logic Saves Lives, Part 3, The Most Dangerous Superstition with Larkin Rose. But first, an inquisitive alien visits Earth.
Hey, an alien!
Yes, I've traveled across space to check on the progress of your species.
Cool. Shall I take you to our leader?
Your what?
Our leader, the guy in charge.
The guy in charge of what?
Well, in charge of everything.
You have one guy in charge of everything?
No, he's in charge of government.
What is government?
Well, government makes the rules for us. It tells us what we can do and what we can't do.
So is government really smart? They come up with wise rules for you to follow?
Well, mostly. But some of its rules are really stupid.
Do you disregard those rules?
No, we have to follow the rules, even if they are stupid or we disagree with them. Government punishes anyone who disobeys the rules.
So you are slaves to government?
No, it's not like that at all. Government works for us, the people. It serves us. We're the boss.
It tells you what to do, and it punishes you with violence if you disobey it, and yet you're its boss?
Yeah.
But there are some things government does that you don't like.
Well, yeah, not everything government does is popular. Like spending on wars, for example.
What is a war?
It's when government basically spends the people's money on weapons and soldiers and then sends them over to the other side of the world to kill a bunch of people over there and destroy their country. I don't like it that government does this.
Well, I can see why you might not like that. Have you humans reached the stage where you generally consider stealing, enslaving, and killing each other to be bad things?
Oh yeah, we know that. Don't steal, don't attack, don't assault.
But you give money to government and they use it to kill people.
Well, yeah. But government does good things with tax money as well.
Why don't you stop paying for the things you don't like and only pay for the good things it does?
No, we can't do that. You can't just decide to stop paying taxes because the rules say that everyone has to pay taxes.
But the rules come from government, though, don't they?
Yeah.
So government made a rule which says that everyone has to pay them money. So everyone pays taxes because if they didn't, government would punish them using violence?
Well, yes, but most people don't mind paying taxes. Most people feel obligated to pay taxes and obey government laws because it's for the good of society. Society needs government, and that means we all have to pay taxes.
So just to make sure I've got this straight, government makes the rules and you feel obligated to follow the rules, even the ones you don't like, and it tells you what to do and threatens to punish you if you don't do what it says, and it uses some of the money that it's taken from you using threats of violence to pay for things you don't like and actually think are immoral, like mass murder.
Yeah, but we can ask it to please tell us to do smart things. And please don't take our money and use it to kill people. We're allowed to ask them to tell us to do what we want them to tell us to do.
Are you guys just scared of this thing? Is government some huge monster that can just squish you at any moment if you disobey?
No, government isn't a monster.
Well, what is it then? Could you draw me a picture of it?
Government isn't really the sort of thing you can draw a picture of.
Maybe you could take me to it. Where is government?
You mean the building?
Government is a building.
No, but the politicians who make up the government have buildings they work from.
So government is a group of these politicians?
Yeah.
Okay, so what species are these politicians?
Well, they're human.
Like you?
Yeah.
So politicians are humans, and they're government. You're a human, but you're not government.
No.
So it's the politicians, they're the ones that boss the rest of you around and make you do things you don't want to do and take your money using threats of violence. But even though you're all humans, you're not allowed to boss them around and take their money?
No, they'd put us in a cage if we did that. But look, it's not like the politicians can just do whatever they want. Like, a politician can't just come up to me on the street and make me give him money. They can't do that. Politicians can only do things like that in their job, when they're working for government.
Oh, so politicians aren't government. They just work for government.
Yeah.
Okay, so government isn't a monster. And it isn't a building, and it's not politicians, it's something else. And it employs politicians, who are just regular humans, who get to order everyone else around and take their money. How does a regular human become a politician?
Well, that's the great thing about our government. It's a democracy, and that means that the people actually have the power. Because we get to decide who among us get to be the politicians. We get to vote. And if a politician starts doing things we don't like, we can just replace him with someone else at the next election.
So the people that get chosen to be politicians only get to boss people around and take their money for a short time, and then they go back to being regular humans?
Exactly.
That sounds like a powerful position to be in. But if you get to choose who does that, I assume that politicians are always the wisest, most honest, caring and respected people among you.
Well, no, not really. I wouldn't say politicians are known for being honest, or wise, or caring. And they're certainly not the most respected people among us. Come to think of it, most politicians are lying, power-hungry crooks.
The ones you chose?
Yeah, they're always doing things we don't like. They use taxpayers' money to enrich themselves and their friends, and they never keep their promises to voters. They've been caught stealing and lying and taking bribes, and they mostly do what the big corporations want. Yeah, they're always doing stuff like that. They're completely corrupt. They're a bunch of lying crooks.
But you said that most humans know that stealing and beating each other up and killing are wrong. And you said that you have the power because you can change who's in charge. So why don't you just replace the lying, thieving, murderous, crooked politicians with some regular people?
Well, we don't try to elect lying crooks. It just always turns out that way. But we have to have a government because some humans are nasty and might kill or enslave or steal. Civilization just couldn't survive without government.
Let me get this straight. Because you're worried about the small number of nasty people that are willing to kill, enslave and steal, you think it's necessary for your survival to have a system where some humans among you, for a short while, get to call themselves the government, and they get to order everyone else around like slaves and, if they want, commit mass murder overseas, using money they stole using threats of violence. Politicians get to kill, enslave and steal, because if they didn't, someone else might? And you try to elect good, honest people to be politicians, but what happens every time is that the people you elect turn out to be corrupt, evil, lying crooks. That's your system.
Yeah, that's pretty much government.
The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his doom. And I stood up to say goodbye like all the rest.
Hey everybody, welcome to School Sucks Live. In the studio tonight, I am Brett, and with me is Corey. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
And our third person tonight, very excited. This is long overdue.
I'm pretty excited.
Author, activist, speaker, and former political prisoner of all things, Larkin Rose is on the line. Larkin, how are you tonight?
I'm doing quite well.
Great. It's great to have you with us. I have to tell you before we even get started, we've had like some pretty stiff competition in this time slot for the last couple weeks. Last week we were up against Mitt Romney's acceptance speech, and tonight we're actually up against Barack Obama's big speech, and it's going to have to be like the best speech ever, I think, to get him.
I think they're going to call it the "You People Will Fall for Anything" speech.
So I wanted to start the show with a little thought experiment. What if we had the power to cut in to the live feed? Imagine this. All these people, you know, it's just as Obama takes the stage, we cut in and it's us.
Just right? Doing what we were going to do
it's
anyway.
Then a picture of you, then a still of Larkin Rose. And we're like, hi, this is a webcam show on the internet. We think that if you go to schoolsucksproject.com, that you will find that this, maybe it's not as important, but has the potential to be a far more valuable experience for you.
Right.
What do you think? How many people do you think would come over from Obama?
I would disagree with the not as important part. By a long shot.
Yeah.
This is way more important than whatever garbage he wants.
I think the feds would be here
within
minutes.
How many people would go over? Just they'd probably just be impressed that somebody could hijack the signal, and that alone might make them pay attention.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the really fantastic part of all of this. So even though we can't do that, we are at schoolsucksproject.com. Last week, I felt like we were getting our bandwidth was getting dragged down by people maybe streaming out of Miami. So that might be the case again tonight. If we lose you for any reason, refresh the page at schoolsucksproject.com/live. If that doesn't work, you can check us out at lrn.fm, where there's lots of great live shows and plenty of podcasts playing in a rotation. Tonight, we are recording part three of our series, Logic Saves Lives, which focuses on, yes, logic and logical fallacies. Tonight is the first show that we are really devoting to a specific fallacy, the appeal to authority or argumentum ad verecundium in Latin. And I think this is an important place to start because, Larkin, it seems to me like this really can open the doors to many, many other fallacies. Like once people are like, okay, yes, I accept this, they're ready to go with all kinds of follow-up fallacies. Like they tend to snowball.
Right, exactly. Because as soon as people accept that it's a valid argument to say, well, somebody really important said this, you know, you can find the most idiotic things imaginable coming out of the mouths of people who are really important. and then people will pile on top of that. You know, they'll fall back on that excuse no matter what actual logic dictates, and they'll fall for anything.
So I want to give people a clear definition, and this comes from the website, yourlogicalfallacyis.com, a great website, fun website. They've got a little interactive poster over there that you can check out, and it's probably, I would say they have it distilled down to maybe the 20 most frequently used fallacies, which is very helpful to learn and to use in your conversations with people you might be trying to convince, or if they're making a claim or expressing an opinion or asserting some kind of call to action. It's good to be able to spot these things in real time, but it takes a little practice. So it's good to distill it down to the basics, because if you look at the whole science of logic, it's a little overwhelming at first. Here's the definition. Your logical fallacy is an appeal to authority. If you used the opinion or position of an authority figure or institution of authority in place of an actual argument, it is important to note with this fallacy that authorities in given fields may very well have valid arguments and that one should not dismiss another's experience and expertise. To form an argument, however, one must defend it on its merits, i.e. know why the person in authority holds that particular position that they do. It is, of course, entirely possible. It is, of course, entirely possible that the opinion of a person or institution in authority is wrong. Therefore, authority, the authority that such person or institution holds does not have any intrinsic bearing upon whether the claims are true or not. Now, the appeal to authority has different categories, but tonight we're really going to be focusing on what's called irrelevant appeal to authority, a type of genetic fallacy, and we're going to do that using Larkin's book, The Most Dangerous Superstition. I actually have a copy of it right here. Just if you're watching on the cam, it looks like this. Yes, I filled it up with Post-its. So we have a lot of notes that we want to go over, but Larkin, you know, you've been at this for well over a decade. I want to start with just a couple softballs about the book. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, actually, I started writing it about 15 years ago, but intentionally didn't finish it until I thought I could do the best job I possibly could. What inspired me to write it is basically my own journey into giving up the belief in authority. And by the time it was finished, I thought, wow, it was kind of stupid that it took that much time and effort for me to come to grips with something that should be patently obvious to almost everybody. So I'm going to see if I can give people a lot faster way to do what took me years and years and years to do, and try to encapsulate basically the disproof of authority in a couple hundred pages. And when I finally thought I could do that as best as I'd ever be able to do it, then I released the book.
And my co-host tonight, Corey, this was a book, yes, that you bought at Porkfest, I think, in 2011.
Yes.
And you said that this was like a very important read for you, right?
It was a very important read for me. It helped give specific shape and a specific set of words to something that I was feeling already. And I'd already been on the road to understanding about liberty and personal freedom and the role of quote-unquote government in our lives, and this really helped solidify a lot of those ideas that I was feeling these things, but I wasn't really. It helped me to really solidify some of my thoughts about them and realize that, hey, other people are thinking the same thing.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, Larkin, I've said on the show a bunch of times before that, you know, jumping off of what Corey said there, that maybe around the age of like 11 or 12, a lot of people start going, you know what, this is just a load of crap about everything that's being imposed on them, right? And it's very easy to understand the difference between voluntary life and being coerced, right? Voluntary life is fun, it's exciting, it's satisfying, and coerced life is inconvenient and it sucks, right? Mm-hmm. So we kind of have this vague feeling, I think, through most of our adolescence of like, this is so stupid, I wish it was another way.
Right.
But we never have that language. And this is something that I think, you know, is really one of your specialties of giving people very clear, very stark ways of understanding this. Like, it's very, very confrontational and you really can't look away. And I'm guessing that this has also led to some friction, like something that we're going to explore tonight in greater detail. But because this is a series about logical fallacies, before we get into the actual book, which we will do plenty of tonight, I just want to flesh out this idea of the irrelevant appeal to authority. Now, there's, you know, appeal to a biased authority, appeal to the wrong authority. This has several forms, but tonight we're focusing on the irrelevant appeal to authority, a subcategory of argument ad verecundium. And this is a type of genetic fallacy attempting to judge a belief by its origin rather than by arguments for and against the belief. So that's a genetic fallacy. Something is good or bad based on where it comes from. It's become very popular in this country in the last decade. Now, there's little examples of this, little fun examples like Bob has questions about evolution.
Right.
Or Bob doesn't like the idea that people have questions about evolution. So he says that he knows a scientist who also questions evolution. Uh-huh. That's an appeal to authority. Right. But, oh, Larkin, it gets so much worse than that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. To me, one of the biggest giveaways that somebody's doing the appeal to authority routine is I'll start a discussion and they'll quote somebody saying something and I'll say, okay, that's fine, but how does that apply to this? Or what about this exception? Or what about this? And they say, well, I don't know. Ask the guy I just quoted, which shows me they don't understand things. They're not thinking things out. They remembered something that somebody else said. Right. And if all they can do is quote the other person, and they can't, you know, they can't even respond to any sort of cross examination or objective analysis of the actual quote, it's obvious that they're trying to do that cop out. I think the reason people do appeal to authority is it's a really convenient cop out because, hey, it's not me. Don't argue about me. I'm quoting somebody else. So go argue with him. And I don't have to, you know, I don't have to argue anything or prove anything or have any thought involved. I can just quote somebody who says something I like.
People also frequently use it to not just to bolster their own opinion, but to tear yours down. Like, well, you know, I think my pastor knows a little bit more about evolution than you. So,
right. Yeah, they'll use like the rank of the authority of the person they're quoting as if, ha, 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 you think you could know something that he doesn't.
Yeah.
And again, it comes down to, you know, if the authority is actually right about something, then evidence and logic will back him up. It'll match. You know, if what he's saying is the truth, then you can demonstrate it by evidence and logic. To say, well, I don't have to rationalize anything or show any evidence because this important guy said it.
Yeah.
It's just the ultimate intellectual cop-out. Like, no matter how complicated it is, if the guy is right, and no matter how, you know, important he is and how many credentials he has, if he's right, then somewhere there must be some evidence and logic backing up what he has to say. And if you don't have that, if you just have a quote from some important guy, then you have nothing.
I'll tell you what, though, if the guy that you're arguing against, or even like the person who is being defended by the person you're arguing against, if that person wins a Nobel Prize, it is so over for you.
Yeah.
There is no greater appeal to authority.
Even though they just give those away to anybody.
Murderers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
I think
it's the most ridiculous prize ever. I can say stuff. Be nice. Do I get one?
So, Larkin, if somebody new is joining us for the first time tonight, and they're listening to this, and they just heard me call the President of the United States a murderer, they're shocked. So I think before we go on with this conversation, it would be helpful for us to give the thesis, or as you call it, the punchline in The Most Dangerous Superstition. And you said you have a copy of the book?
Yep, I have it right here.
So I'm looking for like... the start on page two till about the middle of page three, if you wouldn't mind reading that for us.
Yep. And this is how the book starts. So this isn't like giving away the end of a exciting story or something. It starts with the punchline.
Right.
Starts as follows. How many millions have gazed upon the brutal horrors of history with its countless examples of man's inhumanity to man and wondered aloud how such things could happen? The truth is, most people wouldn't want to know how it happens because they themselves are religiously attached to the very belief that makes it possible. The vast majority of suffering and injustice in the world, today and spanning back thousands of years, can be directly attributed to a single idea. It is not greed or hatred or any of the other emotions or ideas that are usually blamed for the evils of society. Instead, most of the violence, theft, assault, and murder in the world is the result of a mere superstition, a belief which, though almost universally held, runs contrary to all evidence and reason, though of course those who hold the belief do not see it that way. The punchline of this book is easy to express, albeit difficult for most people to accept or even to calmly and rationally contemplate. The belief in authority, which includes all belief in government, is irrational and self-contradictory. It is contrary to civilization and morality and constitutes the most dangerous, destructive superstition that has ever existed. Rather than being a force for order and justice, the belief in authority is the arch enemy of humanity. Of course, nearly everyone is raised to believe the exact opposite, that obedience to authority is a virtue, at least in most cases, that respecting and complying with the laws of government is what makes us civilized, and that disrespect for authority leads only to chaos and violence. In fact, people have been so thoroughly trained to associate obedience with being good that attacking the concept of authority will sound, to most people, like suggesting that there is no such thing as right and wrong, and no need to abide by any standards of behavior, and no need to have any morals at all. That is not what is being advocated here, quite the opposite. Indeed, the reason the myth of authority needs to be demolished is precisely because there is such a thing as right and wrong. It does matter how people treat each other, and people should always strive to live moral lives. Despite the constant authoritarian propaganda claiming otherwise, having respect for authority and having respect for humanity are mutually exclusive and diametrically opposed. The reason to have no respect for the myth of authority is so that we can have respect for humanity and justice.
So before we go on and before any discussion or examination begins, I like to make sure that we have our terms defined nice and clearly. On page two, you're using the words government and authority interchangeably there. And I'm wondering, is there such a thing as legitimate authority? And you seem to hint at that's where you're going, that yes, there is some kind of objective standard. But what is it? Spoiler alert.
Yeah, and the book then goes on to make the distinction and define the difference. There is, because people use the term authority in a bunch of different ways, like they'll talk about the authority on wombat mating or something,
sure,
which is somebody who knows a lot about something, or supposedly knows a lot about something. And then people use the term authority in a situational sense, like I had the authority to go get the purse back from the thief and give it back to the old lady. But the authority that I'm talking about, and in the book I very specifically define this is what I'm talking about, is the right to rule. And the meaning of government I'm talking about is the group of people who claim to have the right to rule other human beings.
Just before we move on into this segment, I wanted to set the tone by reading just a quick paragraph from Larkin's book. This is a couple pages after what he read. The trouble is that the average person's belief system rests upon a hodgepodge of vague, often contradictory concepts and assumptions. Terms such as morality and obedience, laws and legislatures, leaders and citizens are used constantly by people who have never rationally examined such concepts. The first step in trying to understand the nature of authority or government is to define what the word means. Oh, isn't that the truth? What is this thing called government? So, Larkin, you were saying that this refers to the right to rule. What does that mean?
Well, it's not, and the people who use the term government don't even think about this enough to know what it is they're saying. It's not just the ability to control people. Like lots of gangs or individuals have that. When people talk about government and they call their commands laws, and when they demand money, they call it taxes. The way people talk about it actually shows the nature of what it is or what they imagine it to be, which is a group that has the moral right to tell the rest of us what to do and to hurt us if we disobey, and which in turn implies that the rest of us have a moral obligation to obey, and that it's actually immoral and bad for us to disobey those in government. And that's, you know, in contrast to if you disobey a street gang, nobody thinks you're the bad guy. And nobody thinks they have the moral right to rule. They might have the ability. They might have enough violence behind them that they can do such things. But it's the perception that there's something legitimate about the violent domination of others that government does that makes it government. Because if people don't imagine it to be a legitimate ruling class, they don't call it government. They just call it a gang or whatever else. So there's that essential moral component to the belief in authority and government. Authority is basically the right to rule. That's the moral component, that it, because of what it is, whether from the rituals or whatever else, it has the right to do this to us, to control us and boss us around and take our money, and we're bad if we disobey. That's really what is implied by the term government.
So we would all have that right then to do that. I mean, if it was like government has the right to take things from people to use towards other things, then wouldn't that mean that the people would have that right?
Right. We are the government.
Whoa.
Government is us.
Right, we are. Yeah, well, as soon as you start to look at the concept rationally, everything just explodes. It doesn't make any sense. Because one of the most basic ways to point out that the notion of government is bogus is to say, well, can human beings give somebody else a right they don't have?
Right.
And if they can't, then how did the people in government get those rights they couldn't have? And then you could say, well, if they have the right to do it, then so do I. We're both just people. Mm. You know, they may have a huge office and drive around a limo. They're still just a human being. They have the same rights I do. If they can tax you, so can I. And actually, the correct conclusion is, if I can't tax you, neither can they. But that's something that goes against people's indoctrination and against the whole belief in government, the whole belief that there really can be such thing as a legitimate ruling class that's allowed to do things that would be bad if I did it or you did it or any normal person would do it. But if this superhuman thing called government does it, then it's okay. That's really the essence of the belief in government.
Now,
that there can be a thing that has an exemption from morality.
Right. Now, you're throwing around a lot of words like belief, superstition, and myth. Hmm. Around yep. page 10, some people are going to be kind of shocked when you make the assertion that government doesn't even exist in objective reality. But don't we see and experience it like all around us all the time?
No, we do not. Now, people can say, well, people say, well, of course it's real. Look, you know, if you go to Washington, you see big buildings. Yeah, the buildings exist. Where's government? Right. Well, you can see the politicians. They're real. Yeah, they're people. They talk funny, but they're people. Well, what about the cops? Yeah, those are people too, and they have real guns and real tanks and real planes, and all that's real. Right. Government is not, because government is not the sum of buildings and people and guns and law books and all that. Government implies the right to rule, and that does not exist. Again, a gang can have people and buildings and guns and tanks and all that. The only reason you call it government is if you imagine that it has the right to dominate and control and extort lots and lots of other people. Without that right, it ceases to be government. So I'm not pretending that if you go to Washington, you'll just find a big empty parking lot. Right. I know what's there, but it is not government. It is a gang of thugs and thieves and liars that people imagine to be government because they hallucinate authority where there is none. They imagine it has the right to control us and boss us around and take our money when it doesn't. And if they don't have that right, as soon as you recognize that they really don't have the right to do any of that, they stop looking like government and just start looking like a gang of thieves and thugs.
Right. If you take what people think of when they're thinking of government, or the mental images even that comes to mind when you mention government to somebody, a good way to illustrate, I think, that it's just made up of people, it doesn't do anything in and of itself, is if you took what people think of as government and you removed all humans from it, it wouldn't do anything.
Right. It wouldn't be any. There's nothing there. There's actually, I did a talk about this, and somebody made an animated thing of a guy talking to an alien that's on YouTube, where the alien comes down and he's trying to understand what this thing called government is. And he goes through, well, is it the building? Well, no, it's not the building. And is it the politician? And for a while, it seems like it's the politician until you realize, well, no, by himself, he's not allowed to tax you and regulate you. And it basically goes through that and eliminates everything until there's kind of nothing left. So it's not the people. It's not the guns. It's not the books. It's not the buildings. Well, what is it? And it really is this bizarre, supernatural, mythical entity that everyone in it claims to be acting on behalf of. You know, Congress says, well, this is the law of the land. No, it's not. It's some words that you just scribbled on that piece of paper. But they talk about it in the abstract like it's something superhuman. And the cops say, well, you know, don't blame me for what I'm doing. This is the law, whatever that is. Well, isn't the law just scribbles of human beings in a big building? But people imagine that it's not. They really imagine that it's something fundamentally different than ink that was put on paper by human beings.
And this, as we have defined it and described it through your book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, is essentially a religious belief.
Yep, yep.
And we are not supposed to talk about religion in polite company because people go nuts.
But you're not supposed to talk about politics in polite company either, so.
But I repeat myself.
And you're really not supposed to talk about the fact that politics is religion in polite company. And the reason people freak out when you challenge their ideas in government is because they are faith-based ideas. They're not the result of logic and thinking. It's something they were just taught to take on faith, that we have to have a ruling class and that it has the right to do these things to us.
Something that really baffled me for many years, the political versus private or personal critical thinking and emotional intelligence. So there are these people, I see them all the time out there in the real world, and they have these five senses. And they use them in their, let's focus on their professional lives. They use them to take in information, and then they process that information and label it in a way that's accurate and functional. And then they integrate it. They remove contradictions. And eventually it gets to a point where their understanding is such that they can explain or teach it to others what they've assimilated through this accurate interface with objective reality. And then the very same people who are using what's often called critical thinking or the trivium in their private lives or their professional lives will move into their political lives, their public lives, and they will say something like, we need the government because people are incapable of making most of the really important decisions that affect their lives. They can't do that. And then within 2 minutes, they will say that government itself is just and under control because it's chosen by those people. It's so freaking weird, right? Because that's like a huge contradiction. So there's the hodgepodge, right? There's the hodgepodge that you described. People just throwing together things they've heard, not because they're dumb. Like I said on the show last week, one of the frustrating things for me is that I often feel like I'm talking to somebody who might be naturally more intelligent than me, but they're going into this emotional defense. And this is where it gets really tricky, right? Yeah,
this is the kind of thing that being intelligent does not really spare you from. Like, right. You don't not fall for this because you're intelligent.
Right.
You know, it's necessarily.
Because it's a faith-based indoctrination thing that's pounded into their heads that they don't believe as a result of thinking and logic and evidence. They're just told that it is so. And they in their daily lives they seem to make sense. They seem to be able to live their lives, but it also shows the religious nature of the belief in government, because really what it boils down to, now they won't word it this way because then it'll sound as ridiculous as it is, but really what it boils down to is saying, I don't trust people. People are untrustworthy and unpredictable, and some of them are malicious. So my solution is to take some of those people, and not even the average ones, some of those people, the ones that we all know are crooked liars, and give them permission to violently control and rob the rest of us as a solution to solve the problem of the fact that some human beings are nasty or untrustworthy. We're going to take some of them, some of the most untrustworthy around, give them permission to violently control us all, and that will protect us from the untrustworthiness of mankind.
Right, and that goes back to basically what you just said. What kind of people does a thing like this even attract? When it's people in positions instead of principles, it's always, you're right, it's always going to be the worst types of people, as history has demonstrated again and again and again, that will slither, claw their way into those slots. But
right.
Another thing that you bring up in the book that I think is really important, it's you know, more important than what might be going on in the minds of the so-called rulers, and this is the thread that's woven throughout the book, is what's going on in the minds of the ordinary people who, as you say, often make those in power into complete monsters. Now, in an interview that you did with Jan Ervin of Gnostic Media Podcast, I heard you say, I thought this was interesting and very introspective, I don't know what the me of today could have said to the me of 20 years ago that would have made a difference. This is emotional, not just because it is a faith-based belief, but we also have how these beliefs are put into us. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Right. This is a belief system we're indoctrinated into. And I was too. You know, I was taught to be a good state worshiper and to think that the big gang has the right to take everybody's money and boss them around, and anybody who disobeys is bad and deserves to be caged or tased or whatever. Mm-hmm. I was raised in that religion too. And anytime, especially a belief that's that fundamental to the way you see society, literally being raised in that, I saw evil as good and good as evil. It was totally, completely backwards. I saw the biggest gang of murderer and thieves on the planet as the good guys who protected society. Because I was taught to believe in authority and government, and taught that, well, because they did these rituals and there's these documents and stuff, somehow what comes out the other end is they're allowed to rule us. And that makes their actions good, despite the fact that their actions are stealing and bossing people around and caging people. Well, we did all these political rituals, so that makes it good. And it makes any who resist them or disobey bad. So I really was trained to see evil as good and good as evil, like everybody who's raised to be a statist. And to have someone come along and say, you know, even if they don't say it in these words, to basically say everything you believe is totally upside down, you're cheering for evil and condemning good. People don't want to hear that. They want to think that they're the good guys because they're trying to be the good guys. And that's the good news, is the people out there, they're not genuinely malicious. They're not people who in their daily lives go around robbing and attacking people. Most people know, don't do that. That's bad. But they're taught that there's this giant exemption called politics and government and authority that completely turns morality inside out. And suddenly they're allowed to steal, and you're not allowed to avoid that theft, or you're the bad guy. And so they have this belief. And for someone to come along and say, yeah, you're actually advocating mass evil you know, theft and thuggery and kidnapping and murder, they don't want to consider the possibility because, you know, what does that say about them? Oops, sorry, I accidentally advocated mass evil for most of my life. People don't really want to think about that. And so I use myself as the example and think back to when I was a statist and say, you know, if I had a time machine and went back and was talking to that me, I'm not sure what I would say. You know, I'd try all the things I try on people today, but I'm not sure what would have made me dare to look at my own belief system and my own assumptions and my own superstitions and actually look at them objectively and rationally. And to this day, I don't know why I didn't, and then I don't know why I did ever look at them. I still can't say. It seems to just be something that just happens in somebody's head. They'll suddenly decide to dare to look at their fundamental assumptions, and a lot of other people just won't. And I don't know why. I don't know why I did it, and before that, I don't know why I didn't do it.
Yeah. It's very clear, though, why we start doing the other thing.
Right.
I've kind of made a little podcast about it here that's been going on for 160 episodes. Because this is, I mean, this is an institution where you're not learning by like one or two memorable decrees you will submit. This is a very slow and steady experience within that institution. And as you said, your quote that I liked was it trains the humanity out of people because they believe that in this realm and this realm only, which is the most important one, they don't get confused about who the protagonist and antagonist is in a movie or a cartoon. But here they have it completely backwards, right? Right is wrong, and doing the wrong thing is what is, you know, dignified and just. It's very frustrating to watch once you're outside of that.
Right. And the most dangerous superstition gets into how people are very specifically, intentionally trained to view obedience as the measure of whether you're a good person. Heck with morality. If you do what authority says, you're good. If you don't, you're bad. I mean, that's the message that is always in school every second of every minute that you're in school.
So Larkin is our guest. We're talking about his book, The Most Dangerous Superstition, and we have been using this thesis to deal with the argumentum ad verecundium. If you're just joining us, this is the argument from authority or the appeal to authority. And a very short and sweet definition is that this is when it is argued that something is true because someone of authority, like an expert, but oh, that's the nice way. It's also a person or an institution or some hemp paper says it is true.
Well, I mean, people's criteria for what constitutes an authority or an expert in whatever field is really, really thin.
Sure.
These days. Like, I mean, look at how many people don't vaccinate their children because Jenny McCarthy said it's bad for you.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, people will do something if a celebrity tells them to do it. It doesn't even have to be an expert.
So we were talking about this restraining box of authority and how much this hurts not only public discourse, but the public and the society and the civilization. And Larkin, you recognize from your conversations over the last 15 years or so that people do like a plan. And they don't ask you this directly. They don't use these words, but they have some form of, if you don't like the current system, please talk to me like a politician and tell me your 7-step, 11-step, 14-point plan for what you would do, exactly how you would want society to work. Are you familiar with this inquiry?
Absolutely. I get it all the time. It's one of the things I most commonly have to deal with. And it shows the authoritarian paradigm they're stuck in. Because if, you know, if all they've ever heard and all they've ever thought about is how is government going to make this work and how is authority, what kind of centralized, forcibly imposed authoritarian plan is going to make this happen or take care of the poor or protect us or whatever else. If you say there shouldn't be one, they say, oh, well, What centralized plan do you intend to impose upon humanity instead? And it takes a while for people to even grasp the concept that I'm not offering a different kind of centralized, forcibly imposed plan for society. I'm saying there isn't such thing as a legitimate one of them at all. But it's a hard thing for people to even think about that. And they're always saying things like, well, under your system, and I say, it's not a system, and it's not my anything. I'm not running for emperor of anarchy. I'm just going to be a person, and you're just going to be a person. You can run for emperor of anarchy. I'll vote for you.
The best part is, nobody has to vote for me.
Right. You don't need their vote.
Like, in that context, run might as well be declare myself.
Nice. Right.
Proclaim yourself emperor. You're legit because you say you are. Appeal to authority.
That's how it's done.
Now I can appeal to my own authority to prove I am. Actually, that's what the Constitution is. Congress shall have these powers because we said so. Well,
who
said
are you?
You get to say so. We said we get to say so.
And they probably didn't come up with it either. Like, you know, 4,000 years ago in Egypt, there was probably somebody who said, listen, everybody, I'm kind of this magician guy. You know, like I harness the power of these gods, and what you should do is spend your entire life. Actually, it's not a should; it's a must. You're going to build my cemetery. That's going to be the purpose of your life because I'm kind of magic-y. So, I mean, yeah. It was these decrees. That is how it started. But you know what's interesting, Larkin? When people ask this question, what is your plan? How does it work in your system? The whole talk to me like I'm a politician there, that appeal to authority question that has these variety of forms. The question is always like, what would you do about the poor? How would people be educated? How would people be defended? The question is never like, how do a bunch of useless bureaucrats get their hands on other people's money? Because people, by and large, are good, right? So all political debate and discourse seems to be about trying to get at an understanding of what is right and what is wrong, what is moral and what is immoral. And, you know, if morality doesn't work, then maybe we go to practicality or efficiency. But I think people, by and large, are good, and it is their goodness here that's being used against them.
Yeah, and that is the biggest danger of the belief in authority, that it isn't that bad people use it to do bad things, because who cares? Bad people are going to do bad things anyway. It's that it tricks good people into condoning or doing really nasty, horrible, violent things because they think it's for a good cause, because they think, well, this is okay if government and authority does it. You know, the people who vote for a giant welfare state because, well, we want to help the poor. Okay, by means of what? By you giving your money and asking me to give mine, or by threatening to cage me if I don't hand over my money? And this is true of every nasty regime you can think of. No nasty regime came along and said, we're going to beat people up and rule people because, well, frankly, we like power. They never say that. Hitler didn't say that. Stalin didn't say that. Mao didn't say that. They always said, this is for the people and the nation and the fatherland and the yada, 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 and we're going to have justice and yada, yada, yada. Because the tyrants know you don't go to the people and say, we want power because we want to do evil stuff.
Right.
You go to the people and say, if you give us power, we will do great things with it.
Yeah.
And if people don't understand that authority is a lie and you can't do great things with it, because all it is initiating violence against innocent people. You can't do great things by committing violence against innocent people. And when people understand that, they'll stop falling for the politician lines that, oh, if you put me in power, I'll take care of the poor and I'll protect you and I'll crack down on crime and I'll do away with this and fix that and everything else. If people realized, wait, the way he's going to pretend to do all those things is by threatening everybody else with violence if they don't follow whatever choices he says they should follow. The belief in authority totally exploits people's virtue and good intentions and turns it into fuel for the most evil, destructive ideas imaginable.
And they do that by getting you very young and redefining what good is. You know,
yeah.
From a very young age, we're taught that, you know, being good is obedience.
But good is always the important thing to be. The government knows that people recognize a moral authority.
Sing me back home with the song I used to hear.